vacation are going to have a real treat. And that is, we've got Ken Herman, who's a correspondent for Cox Newspapers, and he is going to talk to us not only about being a White House correspondent for print media, but he's going to talk to us about his blogging also, because he puts his articles and also his pictures and videos on a website for Cox News. And he's a good example of the way in which reporting has been transformed in the last, how many years do you think?
Two or three. I mean, the world has changed for us.
Yeah, because when Ken was here in 2005?
Or 2001, the first time.
I was thinking that you came to talk to the students.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
I think it was 2004 or 5. I think it was 2005, and you had just started doing some of the pictures. Yeah. So Ken has reported from Texas for many years. He covered Bush beginning in 1993 when Bush first started running for office. And you have seen several references to him in your textbook, which is Managing the President's Message.
Soon to be a major motion picture.
Who's going to play you?
Don't worry about it.
So from the time that he first began, when he's working for us, you started with Associated Press, didn't you?
My first job years ago.
Well, that was for that. Was that AP in Lufkin?
No, that was for the Lufkin Daily News, a little paper in East Texas, many years ago.
And he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting there. And then he's moved to Houston and to Austin for the Austin Statesman, which is a part of the Cox News chain. And after the Bush administration concludes, then he will go back to Texas to the Austin Statesman.
To the real world.
Well, Ken, tell us something about the about covering the campaign and covering the White House and what the differences are. And I've asked him to bring his pictures, because he's taken wonderful pictures of both the campaign and the White House, and his videos are very good. And he has a lot of videos of McCain, because he's been following McCain.
Here's the biggest difference between covering the White House and covering the campaign. And it can sum it up in two words. Those words are Ron Paul and Ron Paul supporters. I have with me an email I received last week after McCain pretty much clinched the Republican nomination in most people's view when he went over the number of delegates he needs. And Ron Paul, of course, is still running and has not dropped out of the race, has conceded he can't win, but is still running. So we did our story, said McCain clinches GOP nomination. It was in several of our newspapers. And I got an email the next morning from a Ron Paul supporter. Now, I've learned this. The rarest thing in the world to get is one email from one Ron Paul supporter. If you get one, more are on the way. They are, shall we say, involved constituents. So I got this one from a nice woman named Joyce. I'm sure she's a nice woman. And this was her email in total. What a load of horse crap. Paul didn't concede. He just won a congressional seat by a landslide. You, sir, are an idiot. McClain didn't clinch shit. Nothing gets clinched until convention time. Or are you so out of the loop that you don't know how it works? Way to spread bullshit and misinformation so your Manchurian candidate can win. So tired of it, you have no idea. There's a special place in hell for you. Looking forward to your trip. That was nice. It's lovely. And it's so nice that my family members have my email address to send me this. But that's the kind of stuff that happens more in the campaign. When the White House complains, it's a little more tactful and upscale. It's a big difference. The campaigns, frankly, for me, have always been more fun to cover, because you're out there seeing people, a dynamic develops, and it evolves, whereas covering the White House, as I'm sure others have told you, is a frustrating enterprise at times. It's the rare government function where there's sort of nothing they ever have to do in public. There's no law that says they have to have a meeting in public. There aren't many laws saying much of their records are public. It's just a constant fight to get information. And in a campaign, when people are running, they tend to be sometimes a little nicer to the press than when they win the office and suddenly have all the power and trappings of office, especially the presidency of all offices. But it's interesting. Being back on the campaign trail is fun.
One of the things that you did was spend a week with John McCain on the Straight Talk Express. And when was it that you
went? Mid-October in South Carolina. And that's when, you know, McCain was still sort of, you know, the comeback really hadn't happened yet, but there was some sense that something might happen, that, you know, he wasn't done yet. A lot of that based on lack of confidence that any of the other candidates really could pull it off. So it was at a time when it was more like covering, I've covered endless gubernatorial campaigns in Texas, and it had that kind of feel. It was a few aides. It was a first trip. His mother, and we may talk more about his 95-year-old mother. Of course, she's an amazing entity. She
in
was
fact,
out.
We're going to see.
Yeah, we'll do a little video.
The tour of her apartment.
Of her, yeah,
here, here in Washington.
So she was out there. Mrs. McCain, Cindy, the wife, was out there. A handful of aides and the candidate. And you just get on the bus and roll around. And he's very open. And you know, you just sit there and chat with him about all matters under the sun. And it's. It's fun. I mean, it's real.
I remember
contact.
That you said when you came back that there were seven people total on the bus.
Yeah, I think it was something like that, probably including the driver. It just was, you know, it just didn't feel like a giant presidential. I, having done two Bush presidential campaigns, which were, even the one in 2000 was born fully formed and huge. It was never a small campaign. Now, the press throng grew, obviously, as there were fewer other candidates to carry, but to cover. But it was, you know, big deal from day one. The McCain campaign, which started out huge, obviously, last year, and then shrunk down when it had its problems, was a different kind of major presidential candidates campaign.
Can you show us some of the pictures and also the video? I particularly like there was a video of their going into a restaurant, and it's interesting to see the way what McCain is interested in. It was a campaign stop, right?
Well, yeah, it was sort of a lunch stop during a campaign day. We'll see if this works here. We'll start out here. This is a picture. This was interesting. This was in, is that showing?
Do you see it?
Yeah, okay. What you see here is a picture. This was a bar in Dearborn, Michigan before a debate out there early on, and this was apparently Mormon bar goers for Romney. They had a big event there, and it was just different. This is Roberta McCain. This is the candidate's 95-year-old mother. She is the most incredible 95-year-old you've ever seen. She has a twin sister who obviously also is 95 and lives in California, I'm told, is equally as vibrant. The story about, she lives here in D.C. She has for over 30 years. Her husband was an admiral in the Navy, obviously career military also. And she travels a lot, but when she travels, it's just different than anything you've ever seen. She goes to India and just goes to the outer provinces by herself. A few years ago, she drove from Germany to Turkey. And the best story is now two Christmases ago, when she would have been 93, she's now 96, turned 96 in February, she went to Paris, as she often does for a few months during the winter. And she went to rent a car, and they wouldn't rent her a car, because she was 93 years old, so she went out and bought a car to drive around. It's just unbelievable. Well, maybe if we have time, we'll see more. This is on the bus. This is what goes on. There's the candidate, his mother and his wife, and you just keep
riding
around.
How do they all get along?
It seems to be okay. I mean, it's fine. I mean, he is a tough guy and has his moments, but no, it seems to work. And I think he enjoyed having them around. Here's our hero enjoying lunch at one of our health food stops. This was a chili dog someplace. I mean, it's a very hands-on experience.
That one is still up there.
Okay, why are we one behind on the screen and not seeing what I'm seeing on mine? How could that be? This is the Ron Paul people are jamming the signal here. They're very good at that.
Or that woman that wants to send you
can we get it to catch up here? Is there anything I need to do? Yep, I'm plugged in. Yeah, you're locked in on what I had up there previously. Well, let's not get hung up on this. It's just not going to work. It's not following me. I don't think I'm on the air here. What do you want to look at?
Just at your desktop. It's the program that's running it. It's still there. I'm sorry. Let me change something. Stuff never works.
got stuck.
Hold on.
When
okay, hang on.
When there were only seven people there, how much of the time do you spend talking?
As much as you want, almost too much, because he keeps talking so much, and you're recording that. The bane of my existence is transcribing after you've recorded, because it just takes forever to go back through it. And he kind of doesn't shut up, which is great, because he'll talk about anything under the sun. And compared to some of the other candidates, I have not traveled with Obama, but I'm told he's virtually inaccessible to the press.
Uh-huh.
Hillary is not very, this guy is, he sort of made his career on this, on his accessibility. And
uh-huh.
he says stuff. Okay, I think we're back on the air. So here we are, stopped. He's enjoying a chili dog there somewhere in South Carolina. This isn't going to work. All right, let's move on.
No, it's moved.
Did it catch up there? Okay.
Yeah, it's on that one.
This is what goes on the bus. The guy in the middle is a New York Times reporter. The other guy was from somewhere in South Carolina.
Which reporter?
The one in the middle. I forget his name. It's Mark something. He traveled with him a long time.
Uh-huh.
And it just, that's what goes on. You talk about the topics of the day and whatever else. This is your standard handshaking, that goes on endlessly. And then in the next shot, you'll see, this is the slathering on of the Purell after the handshaking. You can get right back on the bus. So
is that something he does himself?
Yeah.
When Clinton was president, I think what they did is he would put his hands out like that.
And someone else would do it?
And the Secret Service did it. But they sprayed it.
Your tax dollars at work. No, McCain
you don't want him sick.
Pretty self-contained on this. And in this next one here, he's putting on some lip protection and his sunglasses. I don't know what the chapstick was about. Okay, this was, and if we get around to the video, if we can make that work, this was, we stopped for lunch at a barbecue place in South Carolina, and McCain is very interested in barbecue, fancies himself as a barbecue connoisseur. I was out at his place in Arizona a week ago Sunday, invited a bunch of reporters out, and he grilled for us, and he takes it very seriously. This one, I don't think, let's skip the next, we'll read it. This next one here, skip that one, you can't read. But this next one is just a sign I ran across. I don't know if you can read this. This was a woman running in Irmo, South Carolina, which is a Columbia suburb, re-elect to the city council. And I think you can read the name. Her name is Kathy Condom. I mean, it's just the greatest name I've ever seen. I guess she'll keep you protected. I think she won, too, I checked back. Next one is up in New Hampshire, Mitt Romney giving the victory signal. I don't know exactly what he won. The Romney campaign was different to follow because he never got as close contact with him, and he went through the motions. Some days seemed excited about it, other days didn't. But with all the money he was spending, he wound up spending $30, $40, $50 million of his own money. He certainly was bought into the effort and campaigned real hard in New Hampshire, obviously from Massachusetts nearby. This is your classic New Hampshire campaign stop, a guy wearing that kind of clothing with that kind of beard, chatting with the former governor.
Did he carry an axe?
Yeah, I think he did. He tried to grind it. This next one, I don't know if you can see this. This is a little kid. This was in New Hampshire also, questioning McCain. He would stop and take questions from pretty much anybody. And
did you have children that were reporting?
Yeah, you have the Scholastic Press kids all over the place. And it's great to see them. And they work so hard not to be intimidated. And they pull in. Most of the candidates are really good to them, which is nice to see because it's tough for the kids. This was in New Hampshire. This is just an aerial shot of Hillary signing a poster of herself. It's amazing the contact people can have with candidates on these. And obviously they all have Secret Service, but it seems to vary. And they really wade out into the crowds. And the ones who want to spend time chatting with the people and really answering questions one-on-one. This next one is Hillary talking to a potential running mate, I believe it was, up there. Not sure what happened to him. This next one, I'm not sure how this got in here. This is a woman you may know serving alcohol. I don't know what was going on there, but we'll just skip over that one.
That must have been the Christmas party.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
In Iowa, during the Christmas break, the Ron Paul people, Ron Paul had hundreds of college kids from all over the country and came to Iowa to knock on doors for him. They rented out church camps and YMCA camps, and these kids came there from all over. Dedicated to the Ron Paul cause. I never saw so many people age 19 who were so concerned about the existence of the Fed and the issues. It was just weird. But they were involved, which was nice. But here's something I warn you about. This couple here in this next shot, they were from Houston, Texas. They had gotten married like a week before. They were honeymooning in somewhere Iowa at a YMCA camp going door to door for Ron Paul. I'm not sure my wife
would
have gone for that.
One of them related to Ron Paul?
No, they just were totally bought in. That was in Iowa. Next one's in Iowa also. I don't know if you can read that. This is at a Elks Lodge, obviously, and it says they're reserved for Exalted Ruler. That's the title I've always wanted, Exalted Ruler.
And who sat there?
This was just a parking spot outside. Never saw it came. The next one, this was a man running for Exalted Ruler. This is Huckabee playing his bass at the Elks Lodge there. Pretty much any event where he could strap on the guitar, he would.
How open was he to reporters?
Pretty open. Seems to be, at least with us, a friendly guy by nature, good-natured, funny, obviously. He has some performing skill in him, obviously, his music, and a good joke teller, and he does impressions. But he seemed to really be enjoying it. You know, I don't know at what point he, you know, his campaign obviously had a strange trajectory. He started out as about a third-tier candidate, wound up near the top, you know, for a while. He won Iowa, did very well some other places, won 5-6 states. So, you know, he did well for himself. I think at some point it was obvious he wasn't going to be the nominee, but as he said, he really didn't have much else to do, so he kept campaigning. And then we had Fred Thompson. This was also in South Carolina, which was kind of his last stand. And I've never seen a candidate so seemingly befuddled about why he was running. He just, his events had no energy. He would just go through the motions. It just was the oddest thing to see. This next picture you'll see is, I think, him poised to shake hands in case anyone wants to shake his hand. He seems to be just sort of waiting in case anyone wanted to. This was at an Elks Lodge also. You go to a lot of Elks Lodge.
Did he find anybody?
Yeah, some people. Next shot is this is a tight shot of Mitt Romney's hair, which became just an issue during the campaign because it never moved. His hair never moved. So I just thought we needed sort of an aerial study of his hair. It's very nice hair.
And what did he think about your taking that picture?
I don't know that he knew what was going on. He was bending down signing something, I think. this is interesting. This was at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire, this site of one of the many debates we had. And these are kids holding signs for the various candidates for after in the, as they call it, the spin room, where you just swarm after the debate and representatives of each of the candidates tell you why their candidate clearly won. And it's always amazing to me, even with objective observers, people who can clearly say who won and lost a debate. Most times I go to these and cover these, and I'm kind of hard-pressed to tell. You know, they generally, most of the candidates do okay. Occasionally you have a moment where it's clear that someone won and lost. But the debates, and there were so many this year, that they just kind of melded together. This next one is a scene in this spin room after, and it's just a scrum of people. I don't even know who we're talking to there, sort of down front on the left there with the gray hair. And it just swarms around, and there's...
Is that Bill Clinton?
No, it's not. There's too many reporters. There's, now you have the whole blogosphere there also. It's kind of a mess.
Tell us about the bloggers. Like in that room, you have a filing setup
right.
Where the regular reporters are.
All the reporters are. They set up, and most of them, it's generally in the gym. It's in a lot of camps. It's the biggest room they have, and there'll just be long tables and hundreds of press from all over the world. And the new thing this time is bloggers. I went to a press conference at Hillary's campaign headquarters over in Arlington the day after Super Tuesday. It was supposed to start at 2 o'clock. She got hung up in the weather someplace and wasn't going to be until like 4:30, which meant her traveling press corps obviously was with her, so they weren't there. But I got there at 2, and there must have been 60 reporters in the room. I recognized maybe 3. And I turned to one of the others I know, and I said, "Who are these other people?" And he said, "The bloggers." And it was a bunch of 23-year-olds kind of sitting like I am here with a laptop open and working. And you just don't really know where it's going. Is this a hobby? Is this a profession? I've come to believe this about bloggers. It's very simple. Some of them are journalists. Some of them aren't. You know, blogging is just a technique. It's like graffiti, which it doesn't tell you what the person who's doing it is.
So how are the decisions going to be made as to who is legit and who isn't?
I don't know. Because you start, for what purposes? I know it, places like for issuing of credentials at the White House, there's a criteria. The campaigns seem to have pretty open season on it because for a lot of them, it's a positive because they get bloggers they know agree with them. Because a lot of the bloggers obviously are ideologically driven or, support somebody and they like to have that. I don't know where this is going to lead, but I do know that it's very simple. Some bloggers are journalists, some aren't. As Helen Thomas, our senior correspondent of the White House says about bloggers, getting something off your chest is not journalism. And that's some of the bloggers, that's all they're in it for. But I was just amazed at all these people. Are they making a living doing this, or is this just a hobby? Do they hope to prove that they're good enough that someone will do it? Because all you need to do it is a computer and a wireless network and you're communicating with the world. It is simultaneously wonderful and dangerous.
Yeah, but that is just kind of getting it off your chest.
A lot of it is.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. This next series, real quickly, this is Rudy Giuliani during a New Hampshire stop. He seems to have fallen asleep on the right there. And you hear the speeches so often, this was him being endorsed by some law enforcement union, that you find your mind wandering, just as you know the candidate's mind is wandering. So the exercise here was, let's see how unflattering pictures we could take of Rudy Giuliani. So there's a nice one there. I don't know why this man didn't get elected. But there's one. That's nice, isn't it? We're catching up here. But, you know, the events are, after a while, you've heard it and you've seen it and you wonder
why. What was
why.
The crowd response? Did you find similar crowd responses for these people like Giuliani? Was it similar in New Hampshire as it was
He wasn't in New Hampshire much. I don't know that I went to a big event in New Hampshire. He came by here just to pick up the law enforcement endorsement because, you know, he had this whole weird thing where some law enforcement loved him and some hated him. So anytime he could get one, because he really didn't compete in New Hampshire, which was among the many tactical mistakes he made along the way, counting all on Florida, which certainly didn't work out for him. But no, because most of the candidates, largely they're speaking to friendly people who like them. Although it's a little different in New Hampshire. New Hampshire's so small, then they said that people there, and it is a good thing, they go out to see all the candidates, not just the one they like. They really go candidate shopping. And they will go to the various events of various candidates. Whereas, you know, by the time you get to the general election, it's pretty much people going to see someone they already know they like. And it's different from Bush, because Bush campaign events were so, especially when he was the incumbent, were so controlled. You know, they went out of their way not to let any dissenting voices in there. McCain's town halls, he takes hostile questions. And sometimes he's pretty abrupt in his answer, but, you know, he's not changing his view just because someone doesn't like his opinion. He always thanks him at the end, thanks for your question, but sometimes it's a little gritty.
One of the advantages, it seems to me, of the process we have of primaries and caucuses in such a large country is that it forces candidates to learn a great deal about the country before they, if they win, before they govern, so that they have a good sense of what the issues are. And in various places, what the conditions are. Do you find any evidence of them learning on the campaign trail?
I think they learn. You know, I think they sort of learn as they have to to pick up votes and what. You know, certainly in Iowa, where they start campaigning, you know, a year and a half before, they know all about ethanol and all the things that matter to them there. You know, they know the people in New Hampshire hate taxes, and you know, they campaign towards it. But you know, it's like so much in our government and our political system, the way we do it, there's got to be a better way. I can't think of one, though. Everything else I can think of is worse, and there's so much in our government like that. You know, should the people of Iowa be so important? It's hard to pick two less representative states of America than Iowa and New Hampshire, maybe Hawaii and Nevada and Utah. But, you know, for you know, not having ethnic diversity and various other things, those aren't the places to go, but that's the way it is. And all the other systems people talk about, you know, a national primary, that's just the richest guy wins. You know, there's too much money involved in that. Yeah. The beauty of starting in these small, less expensive states, something like Jimmy Carter can happen. Now, you can judge on your own whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it allows it to happen.
You could also say McCain, because McCain could come back. Certainly been challenged in the money front.
Yeah, and he was never real popular in Iowa, because when he ran in 2000, he ignored it and let Bush win it there, and he's wrong on some issues with them.
Like the ethanol.
And he, you know, his joke about ethanol was he's fully for ethanol. He said, I wake up and have a drink a glass of it every day, but he's just not for the subsidies. So it's, journalistically, it's fun. The primary season is the most fun because you go around from state to state. Something happens every week. There's a winner, there's a loser, and it changes. As opposed to the general election, which is just this amorphous thing that drags on for months. We think we know what's going on, but there's no voter feedback. There's, you know, polls on a daily basis, but who knows when those are right.
Yeah.
And then we wind up in a place like New Hampshire where, like, this Ron Paul kid stands there with a sign and a big snowbank. And what happens at these, because it's so television-driven, as soon as that happens, he's standing in the snow there, and then a minute later, the McCain people come over to put a bigger sign in front of his sign. And this fight goes on all the time because it's all about the TV pictures. So the McCain won this one because their people had a bigger sign. Next one, you run into small little groups. This was a group of Azerbaijanis for McCain, which I can't imagine there's that many people from Azerbaijan interested in the election, but there they were in New Hampshire. This next one is good. This was in New Hampshire. You'll see in a minute. This is a movie theater. I don't know if you can read it, but it says on the marquee where it's supposed to have the name of the movies, it says, "Too cold to change, need electric sign." I think these were some cranky employees when it was about 8 below 0. So we don't know what was playing at the Red River Theater. This next one tells you how some people travel. This one on the left is Steve Scully of C-SPAN. In the middle is the limo driver who was at the airport to pick up Ann Kornblut of the Washington Post. Some papers send limos to pick up their reporters. I'm riding the Metro. This was last Sunday. This next shot is just shot outside in Sedona. This is where McCain has his vacation home. It's actually in Cornville, Arizona, which is right outside of Sedona, which is just one of the most beautiful places in America. It's just a fabulous place, very New Agey. Everything there is magic and crystals and stuff. And this would be the Western White House if he's elected. And it's good news. They already have a White House in there in town, some little motel.
With Thai spices. With,
yeah, everything there. And then here's next shot is this is McCain at one of his two grills he had going there. He was doing ribs on that one, and he had chicken going on another. And this was a strange event. He's, I don't know if you can see it there. He's wearing a sweatshirt with his family's picture on it that he blamed on that Cindy made him wear. You'll see some other weird things here in a minute. Every time there's something weird, he goes, "Oh, Cindy made me do that. I don't know what's going on there." But it was an interesting event because it was billed as an on-the-record social event where he just wanted to get together with some of the reporters who have been covering him, let him see his place there and just mingle, but it was on the record.
How many people were there?
40 or so, I'd say. And then when we got there, actually on the bus there from where they picked us up to take us out to his place, they told us that any pictures, video, anything you took there was for personal use and you couldn't publish it. And it was kind of annoying because it was sort of an after-the-fact deal, but you know, it was his place. I'm sure Secret Service had some concern because if this does become the Western White House, they don't like a lot of video floating around out there showing the lay of the land there. So, you know, he chatted amicably with us most of the time, toured us around a little. His next one, he's using his barbecue tongs to point out some bird's nest or something. It really is. It's just beautiful out there. It's, shall we say, a little nicer than Waco. Now, this next one you won't be able to see, but I'll explain it to you. You're just going to see a tree limb here, and this is one of the things he sort of blamed on his wife. You can't see it, but in this branch, there are two ceiling fans hanging, and there are wires coiled around the branches. And he explained to us that his wife wanted ceiling fans in the trees. I don't know what that was all about. But there
so
are
do they have
two
chairs
fans.
Underneath
yeah,
it?
Yeah, they move them out. There's actually and there's a swing there, too. Next one is a welcome mat going into his house. It says on it, "Geezer, formerly known as Stud Muffin, lives here." I don't know who bought him that. And then this last one is just him standing around at the grill cooking for everybody. He's very serious about it, very serious. And this is the last one is him making sure we leave, I think, getting back on the bus. But he is, you know, he has his moments. He can be a little sandpapery, and but it's worked for him. You know, he is going to be the nominee.
Do you have some to contrast with the White House?
Yeah, I don't have much White House on okay. here. I have those on an older hard drive. But the White House.
Let's
is
see if your video.
Video. Let's see.
McCain, because you have a couple of videos
wait,
there.
Okay, hang on. We'll try here. Let's see. This will be one from Sedona of him grilling and telling us his recipes. I guess.
Because it's the
audio should work here if it's. All right, I'm running on here. It's not streaming real well, is it?
Can you hear it there? Towson, can you hear it?
I don't think so, because it looks like it's not streaming smoothly.
Well, the audio is smooth.
You can hear the audio?
Yeah. Yeah, we can.
Lemon juice. That's ribs.
He's very serious about this.
So Ken is questioning him about, in addition to his ribs, he's asking him about the land.
And it was funny. You'll see he seems to be chatting amicably about it, and then you'll see him shut me down in a minute, just say this isn't an interview. He seems to be okay here.
a special birding area. You know, native bushes and yucca plants and things like that. We work with the Audubon Society to attract more birds.
How many acres do you have here, Senator?
You know, I don't know because we don't know how many acres are across here, but it's only on this side. It's only about 10, 12 acres. It's not very much.
How long have you been
in state land?
On the other side?
We've been here about 24 years. Okay, we're not doing interviews.
So he shuts that one down. So he's willing to talk about the barbecue, but not how many acres there are.
How can he not know how many acres you own? That's kind of strange.
Yeah, it is. What is the? You can see the benefits of covering the campaign because obviously you've been close to McCain and you can ask them a lot of questions, and they have difficulty getting away from you.
Mm-hmm.
In the White House, they have. It's very easy to get away from you. Because you never get, you know, how does anybody get close to the president?
It's so structured and you only get availabilities when they want it to happen. Whereas McCain.
What's the advantage of it? What's the advantage of covering a White House?
In what terms?
Well, say as a reporter, it's fun to go out on the road.
Yeah, it's much more fun. I mean, the White House is the White House. It's, you know, it's there's nothing like it as far as it being a big deal, but also it being frustrating. It's, mm-hmm. It's hard. You know, they totally choose how to let information out. Some people get books, whole books about it, about how they do that, and it's frustrating.
Uh-huh. What strategies do you have if they try to shut you down? What strategies do you have to try to get information?
You're at the mercy of knowing some people who are willing to give you some. I've covered some of these people. I've been covering Karl Rove in various campaigns since probably the early 80s. A long time. Sometimes that pays off for me, sometimes it doesn't. But they are, by nature, they've always been tight with information. When he was governor, it was difficult. When he ran his first gubernatorial campaign, they just have a strategy and a game plan, and they stick to it. And it's been successful for him.
Do you think that's Bush himself, that's the way that he wants to run things his way?
Yeah, I think it's him. Although over the years, back when I could get to him more as governor, he was frequently my best source for stuff because he could tell you stuff that, you know, staff wouldn't, that I think staff sometimes would get mad that he was letting out. You know, never anything huge, but just some policy things and strategic plans and stuff. But, no, I think that's the way he wants it. He likes a disciplined ship, and they've had it, haven't they? I mean, is there any way to say that they haven't?
No, they've had a disciplined ship. I'm just not quite, I'm not sure how well it's worked. I mean, it's worked in some ways, but I think it's been poor in listening, that they haven't been good listeners,
yeah.
And that's cost them, because there are a lot of things that were bubbling out there that they didn't see coming.
What so many politicians and office holders don't understand about the press is, I don't think we really ask for that much. Just, you know, be relatively pleasant. We know you're not going to tell us everything. Just tell us something and have what you tell us be factual and true, and I don't know what the mystery
and timely.
Is. Right, I don't know what the mystery is in getting along with us, but a lot of politicians seem to, from my vantage point, make it harder on themselves by not just making the relationship work. Some are good at it. I mean, McCain has benefited from it.
Uh-huh.
But even there, you can sense it closing in a little now that he is the de facto nominee. It's
What do you think it is? Because he promised that he saw no reason why he couldn't do weekly press conferences, right? I mean,
yeah.
One time I think he talked about weekly press conferences.
As president.
Yes, as president.
And I don't know that they're still committed to that. But it would be fascinating to see him in there to see how it would change based on how he's run his two campaigns, you know, had their successes. Obviously, he didn't get the nomination in 2000. Probably an underdog now for winning in November, but he's there.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever he's been doing worked for him.
When you were covering Bush when he first was running, how did you get to him? Here, you know, it's just impossible. You know,
as
president, you can't. It's not like he walks by and you can flag
him
down.
When he was running a gubernatorial campaign, you flew around on a relatively small plane with him.
Uh-huh.
The press corps in Austin is not that huge. It certainly isn't the Washington press corps. You know, there's probably, back then, there were more than there are now, but there were probably five or six news organizations that traveled with him. Not all the time, but a good deal. When he first ran in 94, it was a huge election in Texas. Ann Richards was the, we thought, popular incumbent, who he later defeated in 94. And it was just a great race. I mean, it just had a lot going for it between her personality and his family lineage. It was great to cover, and you had very close contact. And then even early on in the presidential campaign, we kind of did, but you could sense when you were sort of losing him to the more national press that he was playing
right.
to. Of course, Texas press didn't matter all that much to him because he was going to do okay in Texas.
Yeah. What do you get by getting close to them and seeing them that you don't get when you're covering at the White House? Yeah. What do you think you miss?
Well, you get to see them more as human beings because by the time, you know, anything at the White House, it's such a staged version of the person. And there probably some presidents who are more true to the way they are. And Bush is a fascinating example because he is still, so shall we say, not so good at the big formal speech. He is, everyone I've known who've been with him in smaller settings almost always come away much more impressed when it's just him talking and not performing or reading off a teleprompter or facing, you know, a room full of people asking him questions. In small settings, he does much better. I've never heard him mispronounce a word in a small setting like that. It's just a whole different package. And for some reason, it's never been able to translate. And one of the theories is early on, he is sort of by nature the classic American wise guy, willing to throw quips around and stuff. And that's the kind of thing that can get you in trouble. And I think at some point they told him, or someone decided, we'd rather you look kind of wooden and in some people's eyes less than intelligent than let, you know, the stream of consciousness flow out of his head. And it was interesting. During the 2000 campaign, some of us had covered him for a long time by then, saw the transition, and it got to the point where we knew when he'd have something in his head that he might have said in the past, and he would look over to a couple of us from Austin, and we'd get this head bob, like, I got one, but the grown-ups are going to yell at me if I let it fly. And it's a necessary change, I guess.
What do you see about him that's different in covering him as a person? In what you see of him as a person, is he the same? Do you see him as making decisions in the same sort of way he did as governor? What's the continuity and what's the difference once he became president or during his presidency?
I think it's similar. He depends on a relatively small group of people who he trusts. He is the decision maker. There is a question as to whether he hears enough disparate opinion, and you know if there's too many people in there who are. You know, so in line with him on stuff that he's not hearing.
Greek chorus?
Yeah, there's that factor. You know, they've done on Iraq and stuff, they've brought in other people, but you just, you know, with contrasting views, but you just don't know if that's just so they can say they've done it or that's it. I've heard him say, and I think Rove say, that they get very frustrated when people say, and it's generally liberals who don't agree with him, that he just won't listen. And in their view, what that is people that think that if you don't agree with them, you must not be listening, because they view those people as arrogant who think that clearly they're right, and anyone who doesn't agree with them must not be listening. And the Bush-Rove school of thought is, oh, we listen, we just disagreed. You know, we just don't agree with you. It's nothing more than that. And so I think a lot of that goes on when they try to reach happy middle ground with people, it just doesn't work.
I remember in a session that they billed as a discussion with party members up on the Hill, that the president was going to go up and discuss Iraq with them. And as I remember, there were no questions. He went up and he talked to them, and he just told them his viewpoint. And he really didn't listen to anybody.
And I think that's, you know, they'll be writing books on the legacy of this for 50, 100 years to come, and I think that'll be touched on frequently. And it's all got to be weighed in the against the lens of, you know, the seriousness of what he's had to deal with, regardless of what you think of the war or anything like that. This is serious business.
When you're covering, covering whether it's a White House or a campaign, is your view of your relationship with the public the same? Do you see yourself as a surrogate for the public? Do you see yourself as asking, for example, asking questions that that the public would want answered? What moves you in these different settings?
Yes, you do like to ask questions the public would like. But it's an eye-opening thing, especially at the McCain Town Hall meetings, when you actually get to see the public asking the questions. And I can't think of any topics now, but it just, you know, there's stuff you never would have thought of. I do remember at a Romney event at a Rotary Club in somewhere in New Hampshire, some woman got up seriously asking about the problem with overpopulation of pets. And it turned out she worked for some organization, and it is obviously a legitimate concern. Uh-huh. And Romney kind of laughed it off as, well, that's not one I've thought of. Maybe I'll put you in charge of that when I'm president. And it just was sort of the wrong tone. You know, I hadn't even thought about it. And, you know, compared to, you know, the war.
Iraq,
It's not that big a deal. But it was a woman's legitimate concern. So you try to think that, but the difference is, you can't ask the same ones all the time. You know, if you ask it and you got an answer, unless you have an inkling that it's going to come out differently, it's done. You know, it's news once, or an attempt at news once, if it produces it or not. But no, people do ask different questions than we think of. Sometimes they're kind of off the wall, but they're all generally sincere.
Thinking of posing questions to candidates or to presidents, you have asked Bush several questions at press conferences. Bush has called on you numerous times. Mm-hmm. And how do you decide what question you're going to ask him?
Something that'll make news. That's what drives it for us. And because those are such, you know, you get one shot, generally don't get a follow-up unless you're willing to look a little rude and scream it, or if you're David Gregory and very big. You know, you get one shot, so you have to phrase it pretty precisely and try to, you know, for want of a phrase, box him in so he can't wander away from it. And it's tough, and you sit there, and it's funny. The whole dynamic of a press conference is weird, because an average press conference, I'd say there's 13 to 15 questions, something like that, a few more, a few less, but not many more than that. And there's a certain pecking order. The front row, the networks will get questions, the wire services will get questions. Those are sort of mandatory, so that's, what, 7, 8 right there?
Right.
Then he can wander, and then he'll...
He does the top papers.
The top papers, but not all. Like, the L.A. Times doesn't always get a question. Yeah. The Washington Post, New York Times pretty much always get a question. So what that means is, when I'm sitting there, and it's a rare place where I will actually have a question written down or printed out, because you just, you want to sound semi-intelligent there. And the problem when you, if I get a question, generally I will be the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th question. By then, the wires certainly have to deal with the news of the day, generally. So that those topics are gone. So you sort of have to be prepared with several, so by the time it gets to you, if one of your topics has been exhausted, you can go elsewhere. So those of us down near the end of the food chart there, I think, try to have something that hasn't been touched on yet. Now, it is also okay to follow up on someone else's question if you don't think it's been, you know, handled enough. I'm not sure we do that as frequently as
we should.
Well,
you did that. You did that after, it was after the congressional elections.
Right.
And Bush had an Eastrom press conference. And you followed up on a question, I think, that Jim Rutenberg had.
Yeah.
And can you tell us about it and how it, because you got an answer out of it.
Well, that was Rutenberg. How did Rutenberg start that one? Do you remember?
No.
But it was just about the change and what was going to happen there.
Yeah.
And it was just, and I don't remember specifics, but he just sort of glossed over it. And sometimes you have to go back in and try to put a finer point on it. And he gets a little frustrated by it, but it has to be done.
And you asked him about how it looked like, how he had lost.
Yeah. I don't remember the specifics, but you know, he didn't want to take it as a personal loss, and clearly it was. And you know, at the most recent one, I'd asked him about. We actually got some news out of it. He's building his library. They've selected the site in Dallas, and you know, there's all kinds of questions about that, where the money comes from, taking foreign money. And he did tell us at that news conference that he probably would take foreign money, which, not a surprise, but...
Because how else are you going to build it?
Yeah, it's the, you know, you need a lot of money from Saudi Arabia generally to build those things, especially with the $200 million they're hoping to raise.
Yeah.
But the news conferences are an interesting dynamic, and the I think he does generally pretty well at most of them. This last one, he started out, you know, he always starts with a little statement. His last time started out, seemed real low key, but once he got into the Q&A, I think he got into it a little more.
That often seems to happen. It happened a lot with Clinton, but in Clinton's case, they used to spend a great deal of time preparing him for it. Mm-hmm. And so he was somewhat worn out when he came in, and then he would work off of the questions.
I can't imagine a president too frequently at a press conference gets a question on a topic that they hadn't at least talked about a little. I mean, can you?
Right. No, usually they've
because
covered
you can
them.
Guess on any given day you can guess 10 topics that are going to come up, and generally most of the questions stay within that. I mean, can you think of a time where there was a question totally off the wall? You know, it's not like the briefing where some are, but because they pick who asks, they're pretty good at guessing.
I remember one press conference that Clinton did where Carl Cannon asked him something about China that he clearly had not thought about. But the thing that was interesting about his response was, you could see in his face that he hadn't thought of it, and he just delighted in the fact that he hadn't thought of it and that they hadn't gone over it because he liked the question.
Yeah.
And he wasn't fearful at all.
Well, he had great capacity, some say more than the current president, I think, just can handle stuff like that.
Because he had such a long background in policy. Yeah. And I remember a time that he called on a correspondent that reports for Cuban paper, who I haven't seen him. We haven't seen him in years. He was a very old guy, and his English was very poor. And Clinton called on him, and his question was just unintelligible. And so it was fun to see what did he do in that situation. So he knew it was about Cuba, and so he kind of talked about whatever he wanted to. And then reporters had their hands up, and Bob Deans, who works for Cox News, called out, "I'd like to follow up on his question." And Clinton thought it was so hilarious because nobody in the whole place could have known what his question was. He said, "I have to call on you." And so Bob was able to get a question that he otherwise would not have been able to get in. Well, would you all like to, let's go to you all and see what questions you'd like to ask Ken.
Did you have any initial reservations about blogging when you first started it? I know that we've had some other journalists here that sort of took it sounds like a good idea, but I'm not sure if I really consider it legitimate or not. Like, you seem to be pretty open to the whole idea.
It gets back to, again, that blogging is many different things. Ours is no opinion. Frankly, a lot of times it just tends to be things that we want to get out there, but we don't think our papers would, think is important enough or big enough to print in the paper as our papers, and I'll talk in a minute about this, our papers' news holes have changed and they are focused more on local stuff. So once it was clear to me that ours was just to be reporting with basically the same rules as in print, I have no problem with it. We do have an evolving situation with comments on the blog. And I don't know what to do with it. I work with a woman named Eunice Moscoso who does a blog called The Borderline, which is all about immigration and related topics. So you start out with a controversial topic. And her blog is different. A lot of it, some of it is just a collection of, what other people are reporting also. It's supposed to be like a clearinghouse for all kinds of immigration information and reporting. She gets a ton of comments. Many of them are, shall we say, intolerant, and it's just not a wonderful public marketplace of ideas like it should be. It's obscene. It's a lot of people typing in all capital letters with 7 exclamation points off it. They wind up yelling at each other on there, and it makes me uncomfortable. And we have some of our bosses looking and saying, "Oh, this is great. We're getting a lot of comments. We're getting a lot of traffic. We're getting a lot of action." That's fine. If that's the goal, it seems like all we're doing is, have something about a controversial topic, point to maybe a story about it, and then invite people to scream at each other, which I think is recreating what talk radio does. And very successfully, commercially, that's what talk radio does. I'm not sure that's exactly journalism. Plus, on top of that, and I guess talk radio has this also, the comments are anonymous, absolutely anonymous. You don't know who the people are. You don't know where they are. You know nothing about them, really. Now, in our newspapers, in letters to the editor, which is a similar function, letting the readers speak about the issues of the day, Most of our papers, all of our papers, have an elaborate process for confirming who wrote it. Not only do you have to have a name on it, but we call you and make sure you wrote that letter. That, you know, I'm not sure why it's different just because it's on a computer. And everyone tells me just because it is. It's a different way of doing things. And that leaves me a little concerned. Just anonymous, intolerant comments, I'm not sure what that gets us.
Who is your audience for your pieces? And tell us, like in a day, how many pieces would you do? Or let's say in a week.
It varies. I mean, yesterday I think I put up about 4 blog items. Today I think I just had 1. And again, you know, a lot of times it's just something you happen upon in passing. And sometimes I did one yesterday that we didn't think our papers would want to actually print on this curious phenomenon that McCain is the nominee, de facto nominee, but not all Republicans have endorsed him yet. There are 22 Republican governors now, I believe that's right. There are 4 who have not endorsed him yet, and each one for various reasons. The one just sort of hasn't gotten around to it in South Dakota. I think that'll happen this week. But there's a curiosity in Nebraska. Governor Dave Heineman's a Republican there, and he hasn't endorsed yet. I talked to his people yesterday. I said, well, when's he going to? And they said, oh, we don't know. And you look back at the history, and when he ran for re-election, he became governor in 2005. When Mike Johanns, who was the governor of Nebraska, came up here to become ag secretary. This guy, Heineman, was lieutenant governor, got to be governor. 2006 ran for a full term and ran in Republican primary against Tom Osborne, congressman and former Nebraska football coach, who's obviously a legend in Nebraska. McCain endorsed Osborne in the primary. Very unusual for a senator from another state to get involved at the primary level, especially against an incumbent governor. Yeah. But he endorsed Osborne. I didn't find any record of him saying anything bad about Heineman, but said all the right things about Osborne, conservative and all this. And then Heineman beat Osborne in the primary. I have a feeling there's some lingering hard feelings, because that was McCain going out of his way. You just don't do that. You don't get involved in primaries.
That's curious, because Kerry, who was from Nebraska, mm-hmm. Bob Kerry, when Clinton was running, and Kerry was running as well in the early stages in 1992. Mm-hmm. He talked about what his character flaws were. And it so irritated Clinton that Clinton didn't even go to Nebraska until the very end of his 8 years in office.
Yeah, that was the last state.
That was the last state.
Bush has yet to be to Vermont.
Where
2 cities last week passed ordinances that if he shows up there, he's being taken into custody immediately, I believe, him and Cheney. So you had those 2 governors. So that's the kind of thing we blogged. I still think some of our papers might have been interested, but some editor made that decision. The other 2 are the governor of Alaska, Sarah Palin, who is sort of an up-and-coming star, is on some list as a possible vice president, though she is now 7 months pregnant with her 5th child. And then there was one other, the governor of Idaho, Butch Otter, the greatest name of a governor ever, has not endorsed yet, and don't know why. And there's like 29 Republican senators who have not formally endorsed him yet, but this will go on. So, you know, the blogging's an evolving thing, and it's hit and miss, and we're still in the experimental stages with this stuff of figuring out if it's worth it. I mean, it's worth it because it doesn't take much effort. I find it's a place you can write a little more conversationally than you do in newspapers, obviously. And it's just another outlet for it. As I said, the world is changing for us. Our chain, we have about 20, 25 newspapers, but the biggest 4 are the Palm Beach Post in Florida, the Dayton Daily News in Ohio, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the Austin American-Statesman. Each of those papers, in their own way, are facing the challenge every paper in America is facing. You see it in Baltimore, in the Sun, wherever you're from. The world is changing on us so quickly, and no one knows where it's heading, and everyone is scrambling around for an answer. All we know for sure is the status quo generally is not the answer. Our papers have become intensely local. They have decided that's their future, to report local news. Hard to argue against that. That's what they're uniquely, we hope, capable of doing, more so than anybody else. The Atlanta paper should be able to report on Atlanta better than anybody else can. So the appetite for national news is down. The papers are physically smaller, so the news hole, the amount of space we have to put news in, is down. Finances are down. We used to, out of this bureau, I would make, in the first 2 years or so, every foreign trip with the president. You need to understand, a foreign trip, if we go to Europe or Asia or South America.
What about the Africa trip? Because Tony Prado was in here talking to them about that.
Yeah, and we didn't do that one, but we used to do them all. And those trips for a 4, 5, 6 day trip can cost $20,000-$25,000 for each reporter on there. At some of our papers, that's half a year's salary for somebody. It's kind of hard to justify. And I think on the Africa trip, they probably had all-time low attendance for various reasons, because now only the big papers are doing it, and there's just obviously decreasing interest in this president, and it's hard for us to justify spending that kind of money.
Has the physical makeup of the papers changed, too, like, say, in the Dayton paper?
Yeah, the Dayton paper is an amazing thing. Dayton, obviously, in Ohio there, not exactly the boom state of the union economically over the past few years. They did a readership study about 2 years ago, and they made this huge change, and they're sticking with it. They have no jumps anywhere in the paper. A jump is story begins on the front page, then it says see page 8 for the rest of the story. Readers do dislike that, but it's just a function of how you lay out the paper. You have to do that so you can get more stories on the front page instead of it being one long story. So they have gone to, and now stuck to it for two, maybe 2.5 years, no jumps anywhere in the paper. And what that means is a lot of their stories on the front page are 7 and 8 paragraphs. That's the whole story. Mm-hmm. So in some days, it looks like a series of Post-it notes on the refrigerator. But, you know, that's what they decided, and we want all our papers to succeed, so God bless them. I hope it works. Financially, journalistically, I'm not sure.
Yeah. What's been the result as far as stories they take from Washington?
Shorter. They're just shorter, and it's to the point our goal is to get our stories in our newspapers is our prime function. Our stories also are circulated on the New York Times wire, so I go to virtually every paper in the country. So on any given day, our stories can turn up any place. You find out after the fact. But our main goal is to serve our papers because they pay for us to be here, and it is expensive to maintain a Washington bureau. We have 25 people or so, and editors and writers. So, you know, that's our main goal. And then when you have a paper like that, you know, 7-8 paragraph story isn't much of a story. And then on top of that, very locally focused. Our Atlanta paper's the same way, very locally focused. Austin also to some extent. And Palm Beach is very locally focused. So there's just decreasing interest in national news. Now, presidential election like this wonderful one we have going on now ramps up interest, especially because, you know, the primaries come through each of those states at some point, have been through all of our states already. But it's, that's a growth industry. There's still great interest. And this presidential race this year is just so unprecedented that there's great interest in it.
In the last few weeks, we've seen some like strange comments coming out of both the Obama and Clinton campaigns. And I read somewhere it's because the senior staff, they're just exhausted after like a year of campaigning. And you've been up close to them. Like, is this true? Are they just tired?
Oh, I don't think it's that. I think nerves get a little edgy at times. But these people are professionals. And, I think some of the things are intentional, that they mean to do it. But it is this is just an unprecedented thing. There is so much at stake. The amazing thing about this election, if the Democrats find a way to lose this year with an unpopular war, whatever you think about the war, the polls are clear, it's unpopular, a faltering economy, a current Republican administration with enough scandal to go around, and just a natural cycle of things. After an 8-year presidency of one party in power, it just generally changes. If the Democrats find a way to mess it up this year, someone today told me a great phrase. He said, the Democrats, once again, they never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. and they may pull it off again this year. And it's aligning in a way where it could happen. I think McCain is the only Republican who had a shot at winning in November. All these other candidates, I think, would have faded. I still think he's somewhat of a long shot. But believe me, he's the only Republican I think would have had a real shot. And now the Democrats are embroiled in this, you know, for those of us who are in it for entertainment, it's great to watch. For democracy, maybe not so much. But they are trapped in their own system. The rules, the way the Democratic rules are set up, and I had a Democrat telling me this the other day, and I've thought about it too, is the delegate selection process, which we're now focusing on, usually doesn't matter. Because the way you usually get the nomination is you win a bunch of primaries, and it's just momentum. You're just winning, and no one even knows what the count is, but you just sort of win, and then it's over. This year, because it's so close, the delegate count matters. So they're trapped into these rules for the delegates. The rules were set up not really to nominate a president. They were set up to keep various constituency groups happy, to have this proportional representation so everybody, you know, has a little bit of something. And now they're locked in it. Plus, with the Michigan and Florida problem of these two states where it didn't count, and they'll have to figure out something on that, they just really are in this prolonged box that I think for their sake, needs to end at some point. Now, we'll have, you know, Mississippi's gone on today. Obama will win big there, but it won't really change the state of the race much. Then April 22nd, the next one is in Pennsylvania. And, you know, there's some thought if he wins there substantially or even just by a little, maybe at that point she'll realize she'll have to pull out, even though by that point he still probably isn't heading for the number of delegates that you really need to win. It's just an incredible thing to watch. And you overlay on that the racial, ethnic, gender divide in the party. It's not helpful, not healthy for them. And just like, and I guess this always happens, that whoever gets a nomination has some making up to do with his or her own party. But it seems even more so this year on the Republican side. Clearly McCain has to work to do among conservatives who never loved him and never will. And whoever gets the, and that's a core constituency he needs. On the Democratic side, whoever gets a nomination also will have probably some core constituency where some work needs to be done. If Hillary gets a nomination, I can see some African-American Democrats really upset. Now, it may depend on how she gets it. If she just wins every election, every primary from here on out, and, you know, it's clear she just won, but if there's any feeling that someone gamed the system, there'll be some hard feelings out there. It might be hard to bring it back together, which is so amazing if that's the challenge for the Clintons, because they have been so popular in the African-American community.
Right.
It's just, it's one for the books. It is one we'll be studying for years to come.
Yeah. Is there generally a feeling, as difficult as it is, just physically wearing to cover a campaign, that reporters are thoroughly enjoying it and recognizing that this is the one election of a lifetime?
Yeah, I think so, but I think the thorough enjoyment is starting to wear out because it really has. And, you know, because what happens is it's so intense when you're in Iowa, New Hampshire, and now you look back on that and you go, did that even matter? You know, you sort of barely remember it. I mean, it's all building blocks that, you know, helps make the whole story. But no, I think people are ready for this one to wind up. And because of it not being great financial times for newspapers, you know, it's cost a fortune. I mean, you look at what the Washington Post does on a daily basis, how many people they have on the road, and they're not staying at the Hampton Inn. They're spending a ton of money. And God bless them for doing it because...
And they got the limo.
Yeah, and they send the limo to pick up Ann Kornblum. It's an expensive proposition, but it is, you know... Most presidential elections are special. Every time, you know, you cover one, you think this one is, you know, the strangest or the most important ever. But this time, really, there's just so much going on. You're either going to get the oldest president, the first woman, or the first African-American. One way or the other. Plus, overlay that on the times we live in, this is serious business. It's.
Can you give us an idea of what it's like on the campaign trail? Like, when you were covering McCain, When do you get up in the morning? How do you get from one place to another? If you're covering more than one candidate, how do you do that?
Well, there's two ways you do it. One, you get in the cocoon and you travel with them, which fewer people are doing this year, especially when there were a lot of candidates. One, it's very expensive to travel on their charter planes. And again, you see the same thing over and over again, but there still is value in that and seeing when it does change. So when you're with them, you're just at their mercy. They tell you to be in the lobby at 7 a.m., and you just get on board the bus or the plane, and you go around. I mean, I did that in 2000 and 2004 with Bush, and it's wearing. But it is fun. It is exciting. More so this year, people were sort of playing zone defense. Like, I would go to New Hampshire or Iowa, and I'd have a colleague there or two, and we would just look at the schedules a day in advance and say, you go here, you go there, and you weren't really traveling with them. South Carolina was interesting this year because the Republicans was a week before the Democrats, and I was doing the Republicans. So I went to South Carolina, and I stayed in Columbia, which is kind of in the center of the state. And there's something about the geography of South Carolina. Wherever you go, it's 2.5 hours away. So I drove in about 5 days there. I think I did like 1,200 miles because you're either going south to Charleston and Myrtle Beach along the coast or upstate South Carolina, as they call it, Greenville, Spartanburg, the real conservative part of the state. So you just you wear yourself out doing a lot of driving to go to events and catching up with candidates and, you know, handlers and advisors to see people when you can't get them by phone. It's just a lot better to get people in person when you can. And it's grueling. It's grueling, but it's, again, the primary season is the most fun because it has a sports feel. It's like a game every week. Someone wins, someone loses, and you move on.
Okay. Somebody else?
You mentioned that the newspapers that you're representing have become a lot more vocal in the news that they represent. Do you find that the readership for those newspapers is still based largely in print, or does that also develop more online?
It varies. Our Austin paper has a, because Austin is a very connected, wired city, has a very successful and vibrant web operation that they're still, you know, the goal is trying to figure out how to make money on it, and finally making some progress on that after a lot of hit and miss for all papers. Our Atlanta paper has a very successful online operation, and they have retooled their newsroom in a very non-traditional way, and there's really a priority in getting stuff online first. And all papers are like that now. You know, the first place you go with breaking news is you put it on the web. And all papers are going towards that. I kind of like it because I spent 11 years of my career with Associated Press, and when you're doing that, you know, it's always deadline. You write it as soon as you get it. It's not like in a newspaper you say, well, let's collect it all, and then at 9 o'clock we'll write the best version of it. At AP, you just feed it on the wire, keep updating and updating, and that's what it's getting back to now. You put it up on the web, you know, the best first version you can, and you keep changing it. It's a much more dynamic operation. But it's time-consuming for everybody. I was talking to Ann Compton of ABC Radio. She does some TV also. She's covered the White House forever and just a great reporter. She was telling me in the recent Africa trip, she was doing a lot of blogging, and her, you know, ABC loved it, but she said it just cut into her time for reporting, you know, for tracking down people and asking them stuff and getting information, because you got to feed the beast, as they say, and it's the same thing you see on the all-news cable operations on CNN. It's amazing what they do to just keep feeding it and keep having stuff out there. It's a large container to fill. So at all the papers, there really is a web focus now, because that is, if newspapers are to survive, I think, you know, that'll be it. The web is the way to go. No one under 50 picks up a hard copy newspaper anymore, as best I can tell.
They do. Several people read newspapers. God bless them. But some of them do.
It makes you wealthier and better looking. We've done research, so continue to do it.
How have they been making money?
On the web?
Yeah.
Selling ads. I think at some of our more successful operations, I think the figure is that of total revenue, maybe 10% is web, which isn't enough, but it's getting there, because for a long time, no one could figure out how to do it. So it's all those annoying, you know, ads that show up when you, and they do it in all different ways.
The University of Phoenix?
Paper. Yeah, they're big. But and just the techniques vary. At some, I noticed the Dallas Morning News has, like, the whole ad comes down over what you're reading, and, you know, you can, they always have a little tiny close this ad button that you can barely see.
But it doesn't work. Yeah, you hit it, and it doesn't close it.
Or it moves around, you got to chase it. And, you know, it's just, that's the brave new world of trying to figure out how to make money on it. The problem is, again, most young people don't view news and information as something you pay money for, because so much of it is free on the web. It's a wonderful thing, but it makes it hard to be in the business of it. And that's where you get back to bloggers who are, you know, ones who are ideologically driven or partisans. My fear is, more and more people will get what they think is news from a source that they know agrees with them ideologically. Now, clearly, newspapers have political bent. We endorse candidates, but more so than people think, there is a total wall between the people doing the endorsing and the people covering the news, and it generally works. It is a good shot at objectivity. More and more now, the blog stuff is, there's not even the pretense of objectivity. And I just don't know if it's healthy for society if everyone gets it from a source they know agrees with them. We have so few shared experiences anymore. Because I'm so old, let me tell you how it used to be better in the old days, children. We used to have more shared experiences. Everyone would watch something.
Now, like the evening news. There were three evening news programs.
And Ed Sullivan on Sunday night for entertainment. But because now there's 800 channels on the cable, in the computer, and I'm just as guilty, but there's, you know, endless things to look at online, and my wife told me the other day I spend so much time online, she thinks I have now read the internet, that I must be starting over again because I've read the whole thing. But we don't have these shared experiences. I think the last one is the Super Bowl. I think that is the single thing in America where everyone...
What about the World Series?
Watches. Not even that anymore. No, not when it's the Rockies and some people you've never heard of.
Boston Red Sox?
When my Mets get cheated out of it, but that's another story.
They did that to themselves.
We just have this, we are so compartmentalized. There's so few things that we all share together. I think election night people watch. I would think in this year, when we get to the debates for the general election campaign, I would like to think those would have a lot of interest. Because it's a fabulous thing this year. The voter turnout, the people interested, it's wonderful to see. And I'm one, I've long said that you really don't want 100% voter turnout. You want 100% of people who are informed or have a party tie that they know, you know, how they're going to vote, but you don't want everyone voting. You know some people in your very own family, you don't have to give me names, who probably aren't really up to speed on who they're voting for. But the turnout this year and the excitement is great to see. And again, at such a crucial time in America, the more people you have participate in an informed way, the better the decision will be.
Have you on or your Cox News looked at all the different papers in terms of, you know what their circulation is, but looked at their readership? Because what you have is the circulation may be down, but the readership is up because of the internet. Can you get good tracking of the dynamics of who's reading, how many, how consistent it is, and who they are?
Yeah, they try at that, but one of the hurdles that is, and our papers have gone in various phases on this, on making you register for the sites where they try to get information. And it was just basic stuff, you know, and you can lie on all of it, but just gender, generally gender, year you were born, an email contact, how you use a paper, your subscribers. But the papers found that just that hurdle was turning a lot of people off. People, and I'm the same way. If I go to some newspaper website that I don't go to all the time, and because I know there's some article there, if I see that registration, I stop and think twice. Do I really want? And we're talking about, you know, a 15-second exercise. We are the worst people in the world.
One reporter was telling me that she puts down, like, you know, like she's 100 years old. Yeah. And that she lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
That'll be John McCain in a couple of years, I believe. But it's, we have a handle. And, you know, the number of hits, unique viewers, as they call them, and I'm sure some of them are very unique, they have a handle on it. And our Atlanta paper has, you know, I think they just celebrated like their billionth hit or something. I mean, they really get a lot. But what each person is looking for, you don't know. And, you know, the goal in the websites is to have just a lot of entries. So, you know, you go on the homepage and there's a zillion different things that maybe can catch your attention. Our Austin paper, and again, that's a very wired community. I think everybody at the paper who covers a beat has a blog. If you go to it, statesman.com, it's unbelievable. No matter what it is, they have a blog. And I think the goal is find something of interest to somebody. We have a copy editor there recently had a baby, so she's doing the new mother stuff. Uh-huh. And you know, I've been around long enough in this business that, you know, it's and raised children of my own, you get a little tired of every time someone has a baby, like, oh, they're the first ones ever to do it. But, you know, there's always an audience for that. Uh-huh. And hers is really good because it has a little motto on it. It says, dividing her time between two jobs, the one with a salary and the one with saliva. And it's, but again, that's the goal. Just throw it all out there and find
so
someone.
You bring up something that I hadn't thought of, and that is the impact of a city wiring itself so that everybody's connected. So they're connected free.
Right. Well, Austin is just a high, you know, has
it's
a high-tech city
and,
you know, relatively young demographic city, and it's just people who that's how they live. And it's all about the web presence. I will go back to Austin probably in about a year or so, and we're talking early on about what it is I will do when I get there. And I was down there last week and talking to one of the editors, and he said the key thing is whatever it is, it has to have a huge web presence because that's, you know, that's the goal. And papers start out with an advantage in a city. They have a brand name. They have a franchise. They have infrastructure. They have reporters. They have people who know the city. And it should be a great advantage. Now,
and it has legitimacy.
Yes.
I mean, that is an important aspect of newspapers, that what they produce has a legitimacy that you know, somebody who's just setting up their own shop on the web doesn't.
Yeah.
They use newspapers. Newspapers are the building blocks for all of those blogs out there.
Right. I mean, there's some who make a living just off criticizing their daily newspaper, a perfectly legitimate function, if a bit of a leech. But anyway, it's important to do it. But a newspaper should say, but the question is the now sacred monetizing of it. How do you make money off it? How do you do it? Because advertising in the print product is disappearing quickly. Classified ads, which forever, you know, was the backbone financially of newspapers, are gone. You know, if I'm buying a car, I'm not looking through the pages there. I'm using all kinds of online tools to find products. The only time I read the classifieds is sort of as a curiosity if I finish the rest of the paper and I haven't finished my cereal. And it's just a curiosity, but it's not really a tool. And now, in the current economic climate with real estate suffering. It's really hurting our paper in Palm Beach. Florida real estate's in bad shape. Real estate ads are a big part of newspaper revenue. That's way down. Auto ads are down. So what the challenge for newspapers is we have some sort of institutional challenges now magnified by the country's economic woes. And what happened after 9/11, when you know there was the economy was questionable for a while there, and a lot of advertising disappeared, the economy came back in a way that, you know, looking back is kind of amazing. A lot of the ads didn't come back because I think advertisers used it as a time to take a look and say, you know what, there's got to be something better. And they're right. There are better ways to sell cars. There are better ways to list real estate where you can go online and select exactly, you know, what kind of interior and what, you know, whether you want white wall tires or not, and it shows up immediately. It's great. And newspapers are getting involved in that. One good thing about Cox Newspapers, we are part of a big company called Cox Enterprises based in Atlanta, and they are a nicely diversified company. A lot of cable systems around the country, Cox Cable, own TV stations around the country, own forest products companies, own something called Manheim Auto Auctions, which sort of controls the used car market in America. God bless our brethren at Manheim Auto Auctions, because newspapers are not the growth industry. Of all the things I've made career decisions on in my now over 30 years in this business, the thing that right now is most crucial to me that I never thought about before is this. Cox Newspapers, Cox Enterprises, is a privately held company. They're not listed on the stock exchange. You don't buy stock in it. It's basically owned by, until recently, one of the women died, the Cox sisters. These are the descendants of Governor Cox of Ohio back in the 20s. And this means two things. We don't have shareholders to satisfy, which is very hard to do in a declining industry to show growth every quarter.
Like most the New York Times
right.
and the Battle.
Most newspapers are owned by publicly held companies, and you have a fiduciary responsibility to make money for these people. That's why they invested. There's nothing wrong with it. So I work for a privately held company, which still likes to make money. They are capitalists, and I'm all for that. But because they're diversified, they can sort of carry the newspapers through this transitional time, and we're hoping it's transitional. That's our best hope, that we are transitioning to something positive. And also they have a spiritual tie to the newspapers beyond just whether they make money or not. And it's just, again, it's something I never considered the form of ownership, but it's a blessing now, and you see what's going on. And we're not immune to the problems, and we've had buyouts at some of our papers, not as much as some of the other papers. And I don't think we've seen the end of that in the industry. Papers are shrinking.
Did the sisters talk about a newspaper as a public service? Was that their view of it?
Yeah, they had, and the one surviving one is 89 years old. So they are from another era. And they, yes, they have a spiritual tie to it as public service that you cannot have these days in a publicly held company because you have a legal responsibility to shareholders. So it enables us, plus some of the executives in charge now share that. We'll see how long it survives because it is still a business and they want to make money.
One of the things that seemed particularly unfair is that with the publicly held companies, that the determinations of the analysts on Wall Street are particularly important, and they seem to set a very high percentage of profit that newspapers, threshold, it was 20%,
yeah,
right?
Because they used to make it. You know, at first, a lot of reporters, because we are a cranky, malcontent lot, when we first started here and things weren't going well, the smart guy response was, well, yeah, you know, they used to make 30%, now they're only making 25%. And it's not that anymore, believe me, at most newspapers.
Yeah.
The margins are very tight. Now, some of them are still pretty good in some parts of the country. Most businesses would be happy with that margin, but it's not what they used to make. But it used to be, you know, a monopoly. It used to be a great thing. Now there are challenges to it. Most are still profitable, but some are barely so. And it's, again, if you're publicly held, profitable isn't good enough. It has to be more profitable than it was last quarter because you have to show growth, which is hard to do in this industry.
Yeah. Another question?
I have one. How important is blogging for media coverage, and do you think the internet will take over newspapers?
Yeah, eventually the internet probably will take over. You know, I think there'll be a print product. I'm not sure what it'll be. But you know, the internet, when it first started, I think most people in newspapers didn't realize what a big deal this was. This is the biggest deal since Gutenberg and the printing press. It's just unbelievable, and I'm not sure we caught on to how big it was. And there were those of us in the industry saying, you know, it's a fad and you know, it'll go away or it'll never be a thread or an integral part of our business. And there were probably people when Gutenberg came out with the printing press saying the same thing, saying, yeah, this is great, but you'll never replace a town crier. And we were slow coming around on this. Others were a lot faster. Part of it is something, you know, it's a big industry, sometimes slow to react. But there will be a time, maybe in my lifetime, where there will be a city without a print newspaper. When I grew up in Brooklyn many years ago, there were 7 daily newspapers in New York City. I thought that's how the world was, you know, and would always be. And it was great. And my parents, you know, on any given day, at least 2 or 3 of those newspapers would be in our house. No one would read the whole thing, but they were there. Then it went down to, you know, 2 paper cities. I worked for the Houston Post. I worked in Austin as a bureau chief there from 1988 to 1995. When the Houston Post went out of business, basically was bought up and shut by the competition, the Houston Chronicle. And this went on in Texas. Dallas used to have 2 papers, El Paso had 2, San Antonio had 2. It's all gone now. And I tell you, there was a time in Dallas when it was a big newspaper war. It was great. I mean, those were good newspapers. Ambitious, make mistakes sometimes, but incredible energy going on. That's gone now. And now I think, you know, there are very few 2 paper cities, just the biggest ones. And eventually, you could see a city where they don't print it anymore. They're hard to deliver. You know, you have to get them out there early in the morning. It's expensive. And at some point, you know, 2 lines are going to cross where it's just not worth it anymore. An interesting dynamic in newspapers, it used to be morning papers and afternoon papers. Afternoon papers died, mostly in the 80s, some a little later, but they died. The biggest reason they died was just too hard to deliver in rush hour in cities. But the reality is, for other reasons, maybe the afternoon paper should have survived, because I think a large portion of newspaper readers, those that are left, the paper hits their doorstep at 6 in the morning, their lives are so busy, they may not look at it till the evening anyway. So here you have a product that even at 6 a.m. when it gets there, it's somewhat dated because of the internet and everything else. And then they're waiting 12, 14, 16 hours later to read it. It means it has to be a different kind of product. I wonder sometimes, you know, I told you about our Dayton papers doing a lot of short stories for a quick read. Maybe we're, and I'm guessing here, but maybe we should be going the other way and just realize at some point, and I hate to even say this, that the newspaper is not a general interest product. It's for a small group of people, a smaller shrinking group of people who want to read, and maybe they should be longer stories. I can't imagine that's a good marketing philosophy, but who knows? And the newspaper as sort of a mass communication device, the print version of it, is changing because the readership is shrinking. And it will all migrate online in some form at some point. Because it's better, it's faster, it's quicker, it's more entertaining.
Well, except that if you read online, there's so many things that you miss that that you read when you're looking through a regular paper.
The difference is in the print product, the stuff you happen upon. Because even if you know, I'll turn the page and I'll at least read the headline, whereas the internet is a more tunneled experience.
Right.
And that's why some of the websites they will try on that. On the home page to have a zillion different things. Now, sometimes it's so many as to be none because there's so many there. But the goal is to have as many points of entry as possible. But yeah, there is something to be said, I believe, for the experience of just turning the pages and coming upon something you didn't know was going to be there. But the market seems to be speaking.
Yeah, right. The whimsical pieces. Well, thank you very much, Ken.
Sure.
I appreciate it.
Glad to do it. Can we give them homework now?
Now they get their test.
And you told me this is going to be the hardest one ever. Is this the first one you're doing in Latin?
Have a nice vacation.